This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiotakis. More than 7,000 miles away from here is a place whose politics matter to a lot of Angelenos. A lot of folks are closely watching Israel's parliamentary elections, with LA home to some of the largest Jewish and Palestinian communities in the world, including Zev Opos, who is very involved in local Jewish life.
You know, a lot of the LA's Jewish community cares a lot about what the next chapter of this evolving Jewish state looks like. And in a lot of cases, what's important to them is that it does remain democratic, progressive values, and at the same time, coexistence in a secure fashion so that Israel, you know, does not face an existential threat.
Well, so far, the election results are inconclusive. Current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his party are well short of a majority. His chief challenger, a man named Benny Gantz, he may have won more seats in this election. So what happens next is still very much up in the air. And with more, KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb joins us here in the studio. Hi, Benjamin.
Hello, Steve.
Give us the latest on the election right now with the numbers. What's likely to happen next?
So Israel has a parliamentary system of government. Voters officially elect parties and not candidates. And then each of those parties tries to secure a majority in the parliament, the Knesset, and put its person forward to become the next prime minister. Now, what's become kind of the norm in Israel is that no party wins outright majority, and so what they need to do is form what's known as a coalition government by banding together with others. The current prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is from the Likud party, long-time political figure in Israel, army veteran, and now prime minister for the past decade or so.
And a very polarizing figure for sure. What about his main challenger there?
His main challenger is a man named Benny Gantz of Kolot Levon, or the Blue and White Party. It's a centrist group, and there is some hope among some of the more left-leaning folks that if it were able to form a government, the country would move away from some of Netanyahu's more hardline policies. And I emphasize hope because there's also a feeling that both of these parties may actually be very similar in their policy. Right now, the two parties appear to have secured a similar number of votes, with Gantz ahead by maybe one seat. And so the question becomes, who will be able to put that coalition together?
So what does it mean? One seat. What does it mean for the future of the current prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu?
Netanyahu has a lot, and I cannot emphasize that enough, a lot riding on this election. He's facing corruption charges, bribery, fraud, etc. And I asked Jessica Marglin about the stakes. She's a professor at USC, and she studies, among other things, Jewish-Arab relations in the Middle East.
He's not the first politician in Israel to be charged with corruption and bribery. This is a problem that, you know, many politicians have had. It certainly seems like part of the reason that perhaps he was unable to form a government the first time around back in the spring was precisely that he was making kind of outrageous demands from his potential coalition partners to, you know, protect himself.
And Steve, when she says protect himself, what she's referring to is protect himself from going to jail.
Yeah, under the investigations obviously going on there. So what is important, Benjamin, to Israeli and Jewish Angelenos who are keeping a close eye on what's going on over there?
Like any big election in the U.S., for example, it's very hard to generalize. You did hear from Zev Opos earlier. Take a listen to his take on this.
Although I don't agree or condone Netanyahu's corruption, if Netanyahu would win, I wouldn't be mad. I could be one of those people who can overlook, you know, particular downfalls of Bibi in order for Israel to stay a secure state as it's been, you know, in the last 10 or so years.
10 or so years, the tenure of Bibi. Security, a major consideration for Zev. But he also told me that he's happy with some of the socioeconomic trends that he's been seeing in Israel and among members of the diaspora. Now, not everyone is willing to overlook Netanyahu's shortcomings. I caught up with Uri Tzalil on the phone. He's Jewish, in his 70s, works in real estate here in Los Angeles. He's originally from Haifa, which is a small town, which is actually a big town in northern Israel. And he came to the U.S. in the 1970s.
Netanyahu is a brother from another mother to Trump. He lies. He lies a lot. But right now, none of the Israeli politicians, you know, I'll sell them to you a dime a dozen. And I don't even ask for any change.
Do you think Netanyahu belongs in a jail cell?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, he's not mincing words there. There's already been an election this year, though, Benjamin, a few months back. This is the second one. Is there a possibility that this whole thing falls apart?
Absolutely. And that's what we're all watching here as the week continues.
All right. So what about local Palestinians, members of the Palestinian diaspora? How are they looking at the results of this election so far?
I'm really glad you asked that, because it's important to remember that the vast majority of Palestinians cannot vote in this election. There is a sizable Arab population in Israel that have citizenship and can vote. It's about 20% or so of the population of Israel, according to some recent government figures. And actually, the Arab coalition did relatively well this election. However, with many things in Israel, the identity of Arab citizens is also very political. Many, if not most, Arabs living in Israel self-identify as Palestinian. And historically, they have not turned out to vote because they haven't felt they were represented. Mm. Although that may be changing with a coalition of Arab parties coming in third place this time. Now, I spoke with Sari Magdesi about this. He's a professor at UCLA, author of Palestine Inside and Out. And he says Palestinians living in the diaspora see the Israeli candidates as really different representations of the same policies,
which is continued Israeli occupation, continued Israeli domination of Palestinian life, continued refusal of the right of return to Palestinian refugees living in exile, and more of the same and on, essentially. So, yeah, I mean, substantively, there's not really going to be much of a difference. The difference, if there is any difference, as I said, it's in the packaging rather than in the substance.
And by packaging, what he's referring to is how Israeli politicians talk about the realities on the ground. The Israeli occupation, as he puts it, of the West Bank and Gaza, the illegal settlements in the West Bank, those issues. I have to point out that many Israeli and Jewish Americans would disagree with that characterization of what's happening in Israel with the Palestinians. Nonetheless, Magdesi says that actually Palestinians would prefer an honest representation of, in his mind, the realities on the ground.
Many Palestinians would prefer to have an Israeli leader who, like Netanyahu, who's blunt and in a way, you know, honesty is better than kind of prevarication and equivocation and endless word plays and deferral of honesty, which doesn't help anybody, I don't think, particularly.
Sounds like he's saying the devil you know, right?
Yeah, but also part of the reason for this is what Magdesi describes as a growing trend, not just in academia, but among Palestinians and in the diaspora as well, of abandoning the two-state solution, which we've talked about a lot, you've heard about a lot, viewing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as something happening inside of one state. So when you start to do that, all the arguments that label Israel as, for example, an apartheid state, the boycott and divestment movement, for example, through that lens, those things start to look a lot differently than when you're talking about two states. And he added that, Magdesi did, that many Palestinians are fed up with their own leadership, Fatah and Hamas as well.
Mm. All right. So when are we going to know whether Bibi Netanyahu is in a courtroom or continuing as prime minister?
Well, it's very hard to say. The president of Israel has an important role here, seeing who can put together a coalition, if a unity government should be formed. This is a collection of parties with widely different views. Generally, the party with the most votes gets a first try, a first pass at forming a coalition. That's not always how things turn out. So the unofficial count right now has Netanyahu and his Likud party falling behind by one vote shy of his challenger.
One vote. Wow. All right. Well, we're going to continue to watch this as the rest of the world does indeed. What happens in Israel, who will form a government, how that will affect the lives of Israelis and Palestinians alike. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb. Ben, thanks.
Anytime.
Well, we're in the last stretch of KCRW's UnDrive Pledge Drive. What's that? You didn't know we were in a fundraiser? What? Yeah, that's because we're doing this seconds at a time. No interruptions of the programming. Just my telling you for like 10, 20, 30 seconds that, hey, we're here asking for your support of public radio. You get what you always get, and we only ask you to think about what you get at KCRW. The programming, quality journalism, cultural and music shows that make you happy or make you think. And if you contribute now, you're going to automatically be entered into a special sweepstakes where you can win an all-inclusive pass, or actually a couple, to Wilco's Sky Blue Sky Festival along Mexico's Riviera Maya. KCRW.com/join is how to do it. And thank you for your support. Coming up, a plastic spill in Sacramento that got the last day heave-ho. So what's next in an effort to deal with plastic waste? It's Greater L.A. You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you were listening to Press Play in the last hour, you heard KCRW reporter Kaylee Wells describe her experience trying to live without plastic for a week. Spoiler alert, she found it just about impossible. And last week on this show, KCRW's Warren Olney reported about how plastic is pretty much everywhere these days. more than half of all the plastic in the world has been manufactured in just the last 13 years. Can you believe that? Part of Warren's report was a conversation with Santa Monica State Senator Ben Allen. He put forward a bill to eliminate 3/4 of all single-use plastic containers in the next 10 years. But the legislature adjourned last week without voting on that bill. We wanted to follow up on it, so Senator Allen joins me right now. Hi.
Hey there. Good to hear from you.
What happened? Why do you think the bill failed to get enough support from your colleagues there?
Well, it's a convoluted and complicated story, and I actually don't believe that it failed to get enough support from my colleagues. I think we actually had the votes to get it off the floor, but the day became a crazy day for a number of factors. There was another major competing environmental bill that was in the mix. There was a lot of obfuscation and lies being thrown around by just a few lobbyists that I think that confused the matter a little bit. We had, you know, an anti-vaccine protester who threw menstrual blood onto the Senate floor, which delayed the proceedings pretty considerably and I think led to a lot of tensions between the two houses. And in the end of the day, it became a casualty of a lot of the last-minute kabuki theater of the final day of session. You know, I'm taking a lot of lessons from this experience about engaging leadership a little bit early, not waiting until the last day to get these bills through. And in the end of the day, I think we just have to keep telling the story to our colleagues and everyone who can listen about how incredibly important it is for us to step forward and actually take ownership of this crisis that we have with regards to waste management. I think, you know, we basically had the deal tied up in a bow by Monday. You know, the American Chemistry Council had stood down. We weren't able to negotiate a deal with them, the American Beverage Association, the retailers, the grocers, a whole number of industry groups. So I think we're actually very well placed to get this across the finish line in the coming year. And I'm looking forward to making sure that happens.
Now, you mentioned lobbyists were, you know, there was some obfuscation. There were, you know, some words from lobbyists that may have muddied the issue. The plastics industry, the fossil fuel industry, they both opposed your bill. What do you say to them to get them on your side? You said you got chemistry companies and things like that on your side and the grocers and beverage companies. What about the plastics industry?
Well, the American Chemistry Council actually involves a lot of folks in the plastics industry. They were the ones who took the lead in the past in opposing the plastic bag ban and in the microbeads and the microplastics work that has happened before the legislature. So, you know, what we say to them is, look, we are absolutely determined to do something about this. We have to reduce our waste. We're not putting you out of business. We're just asking you to shift to a more sustainable model. There are things that they can do to significantly increase the recyclability, reusability, compostability, biodegradability of their various products. And we need to shift them in that direction.
So how does your bill do that then? What is it about your bill that you think, well, everyone can be on board with this?
Well, in the end of the day, what we do is we set out big goals out into the future, but we have a long runway, a lot of time to get to those goals. And we set up a very robust stakeholder process that thoroughly engages industry. And I think at the end of the day, that's what made the American Chemistry Council feel more comfortable with what we were trying to do. We made sure we built in all these opportunities for them to weigh in, to be heard, to be engaged with, to be sought after for their input and their advice. And they would be an essential piece of the of helping us come up with the solutions.
The interesting thing about all of this, obviously, is the fact that China has stopped taking a lot of plastic recycling from the United States, from a lot of countries in the world. So the bottom has kind of dropped out of that market, and a bunch of recycling centers have shut down as well. That means landfills and the environment getting inundated with plastic garbage. How do you see us getting out of this mess? I mean, obviously, your bill is trying to mitigate that. But there's something, I think, a little more urgent in what China has done.
Absolutely. What the bill does that I think is so important is that by setting targets and goals, it will send really strong market signals out there, both to the manufacturing folks, but also folks who work in the waste management space, to help to reinvigorate investment, both in more sustainable packaging, but also in the recycling infrastructure. Because the bottom has fallen out on the recycling infrastructure, it has led to a situation where investors just don't feel a lot of confidence investing in reboosting and rebuilding the recycling infrastructure. And one of the things that's so important about our bill is that it will help to reinvigorate the recycling infrastructure by creating recycled content standards and by creating a set of government-backed goals to ensure greater recyclability.
I want to read to you what Shannon Crawford, you may have seen this. She's the executive director of state government affairs for the Plastics Industry Association, who said, quote, "We remain opposed because we think there are some fundamental flaws in the bill which would prevent it from being implemented." How do you respond to that?
You know, that is a obvious thing for anyone who stands to lose, you know, by the bill to say. I hope that she will take a cue from the many, many industry folks who sat down with us through the course of the summer and understood that what we were doing was reasonable, that we had built in tons of off-ramps, that we built in lots of flexibility, lots of room for engagement. You know, there's some organizations where they have a few members who are excited about trying to get on board something like this, and they take a proactive stance and they say, hey, let's try to make this work for our members who want to do the right thing. And there are other groups who represent folks who just don't want to get there. And a lot of them are folks who are based out of state. I mean, we saw a really interesting dynamic between some of the in-state folks or some of the other folks that were really working hard to be more sustainable, and those that just didn't want to change their business model at all. And, you know, I just hope that she will listen to some members of the industry and understand that the state of California is dead serious about doing something about this. And she will either be part of the solution or not.
Well, the association has cited children's food products and toothpaste, those things that need single-use plastic and would be much more expensive if your bill goes through. How do you respond to that? And you know, again, the words are fundamental flaws which would prevent it from being implemented. I mean, those are the types of things where they say there could be a real problem in going forward.
Well, we had folks come in, talk to us over the summer about infant formula, for example, and we were able to get some language there that made the folks who made the infant formula products feel more comfortable. We are totally open to reasonable edits and changes to the bill, but we are not going to go away. We are not kind of standing down from the broad goals of the bill. So let's have those conversations over the fall. I will say I think that the claims that she's making are a little overblown. I think there's a way to get there. The question is going to be, are they willing to work with us on finding a solution to their problems, or are they just going to try to keep throwing in monkey wrenches?
State Senator Ben Allen of Santa Monica. Senator, thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for talking to us today.
And we asked Shannon Crawford from the Plastics Industry Association to join us today. She was unavailable, but she did send us a statement. Quote, "While we remained opposed to SB 54 due to fundamental flaws that would have prevented proper implementation, we were encouraged by the final round of amendments, which we believe were the result of significant discussion with the legislature, with legislators, I should say. We continue to support the overall intent of this bill to increase the proper recycling and recovering of all plastic." And it goes on to say that we, quote, "changed our position to neutral." So perhaps some good news for Senator Allen's bill going forward. Well, while there may be an effort by lawmakers to regulate the amount of plastics being made, one artist is trying to take all that plastic waste and turn it into artistic beauty. Artist Moffat Takadiwa has work over at the Nicodeme Gallery in downtown LA. Takadiwa is from Zimbabwe. And he says through his art, he wants to make a statement about consumerism and plastic waste by utilizing all those items that you throw away day in and day out, and items that wind up in all different kinds of places on Earth, particularly his home of Zimbabwe. Our art insider, Lindsay Preston Zappas, is editor-in-chief over at Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, and she visited this exhibition, and she joins me right now. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Steve.
So, all right, when I say waste,
yeah,
we're talking about, like, this plastic waste is specifically from America.
Yeah. So waste is a huge problem in Zimbabwe, well, in the world, but in Zimbabwe, it not only is in landfills, but it's spills onto the streets, and it's really part of the daily fabric there. But a lot of this trash literally is being shipped there from America, from Western European countries, and the government is selling parcels of land to take on trash and refuse from other countries.
So the country is making money from America. America's paying Zimbabwe, hey, take our trash.
And not just Zimbabwe, but Southeast
other
Asia.
Countries, sure.
I actually read this quote that says it costs more money to move a bale of trash across Los Angeles than it does from LA to Hong Kong.
Wow. And so, all right, all this plastic waste that winds up in Zimbabwe, this is where Takadiwa lives, and he takes this waste and he makes it into what?
They almost look like tapestries at first. He's using things like keyboard keys, toothbrush bristles, Mountain Dew caps, and he's weaving them together to create these gorgeous tapestries that, you know, reference a lot of African patterning and African weaving. The work has this really interesting thing that from far away, you see the color and patterning and composition, and then as you get closer, the material kind of pops out at you.
Did any piece stand out to you? Was there something there that you were like, oh yeah, that means a lot, or wow, that's pretty heavy?
Yeah, I mean, each work kind of focuses on specific materials. So there are some that focus on keyboard keys, for instance. These he collects from South Africa. So he's going to landfills in both Harare, where he's from, in Zimbabwe, but also South Africa for more of the tech supplies, I guess. And the artist is using the keyboard keys specifically to talk about kind of colonial imprints on Africa and Zimbabwe and the English language. Hello. So I think by deconstructing computer keyboards and then reweaving those letters together, he's sort of inventing a new structure, a new language, if you will.
When I think about all this, the first thing that came into my mind was, oh my gosh, he probably hates us all, right? Like, all our trash from America winds up, or much of the trash in America winds up in other countries in the world, particularly Zimbabwe, one of the countries that takes our trash. And he's looking at this and being like, you know, gosh, you people are a bunch of slobs, or, you know, I mean, like, I mean, like, what is it? What is the intention, do you think, of putting all this together? What is his relationship with this stuff?
It's complicated, right? Because I think really he's an artist and all artists seek out beauty. So at its core, these works, you know, they're very confrontational in that, and as Americans, it's easy to feel like he's confronting us with our own trash, our own problem. So then, you know, if you think about it that way, it becomes a really potent, intelligent thing that he's doing. Like, he's taking trash that we're shipping to his country, sanitizing it, weaving it together, repurposing it into these gorgeous textile pieces, and then shipping it back to us and making a lot of money off of these works that then goes back to supporting his community. So it becomes, you know, he's kind of using and working within these systems that are very oppressive and very problematic, but he's finding beauty within them and really is seeking out beauty and hope and wants to bring that back to his community.
What did you take away when you were leaving?
I think the work really unfolds, right? So at first I was really struck with just the beauty of the pieces. They're highly skilled, highly detailed works. But yeah, then as I said, I'm struck with my own waste and I'm on my own personal kind of anti-single-use plastic journey. So, you know, I was very struck with that. These works are filled with single-use plastic. But then, you know, you start to consider the artist's context and the context he was living in. And kind of these like colonial forces that have oppressed him for so long. And, you know, the artist really doesn't separate environmental issues and political issues. Like, he talks about that as one thing. And I think it's great timing with the climate strike this Friday just to sort of reconsider how all those things are connected and really kind of shine a light on that.
And look at what this guy did with all that with all that waste.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Mafat Takadiwa's exhibit, Son of the Soil is what it's called, is on display over at the Nicodeme Gallery through October 19th. Lindsay Preston-Zappas, our art insider. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks so much.
You can, by the way, check out some photos of this exhibit. They're incredible. And sign up to receive Lindsay's weekly art insider newsletter at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Well, that's it for today. Tomorrow, the industry is called goods movement. Think Amazon. It's fulfillment centers. They're increasingly becoming automated. What does that mean for the Inland Empire, where there are so many of those warehouses, dozens and dozens of them? Next on KCRW, all the president's lawyers, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, PJ Shahamat, and Christian Bordahl all make this show happen. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Online, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Thanks for your ear. Have a great day.
There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. I, you know, they always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if there's a fixer.